Chapter 4. Plandemic 2.
They who can give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. Quote by Benjamin Franklin.
July 2020, Ojai, California. Never before has there been so much transparency and openness to ideas. Never before has there been such tribalism, misinformation, and virulence in the name of truth. The internet has made both possible, and perhaps no one was more aware of that catch-22 than the Plandemic team were in the summer of 2020. As the coronavirus continued to rage among us, and some of the most chilling predictions of the film came true, they watched the trolls and critics continue to slander and smear them. Most often, it was for things they'd never actually said.
The media made a huge fuss over the fact that we used stock footage to visually illustrate a couple of moments within Dr. Mikovits' story. As Judy told the story of her arrest, lacking the actual footage, we used a clip obtained from a stock library. Anyone with a little knowledge of basic documentary filmmaking knows that the use of what's called B-roll is a common practice. The proper question is, did we portray the recreation honestly? According to Judy, the clip we used was mild in comparison to the actual police raid that took place at her home. So if anything, we downplayed the moment. Still, critics insisted that this was proof that we had fabricated the entire story.
Overall, it seemed, most of the criticisms had nothing to do with their argument. They chose to focus on the tearing down of Dr. Mikovits' character. Yes, she's complicated, but that does not make her a liar. The bottom line for many people, it seemed, was, but she's been arrested. People didn't care that the Plandemic team knew all about that going in. In fact, they had the arrest warrant, a warrant that was never signed, making it invalid. Just like she claimed, Dr. Mikovits never had a single charge filed against her. None of that mattered. Judy Mikovits had already been ruled guilty in the court of public opinion.
Like all of us, Judy Mikovits is imperfect. Because of what she's been through, her emotions can at times override her ability to communicate like one might expect a scientist at her level to communicate. To magnify these human flaws, however, is to distract from the content of her testimony, a grave error.
To avoid stepping in that trap again, Mickey decided to feature other whistleblowers in Plandemic 2.
Knowing we were under the microscope of the world, this time I hired a team of researchers to ensure that every claim made in Part 2 was unassailable. I also brought on my friend and producer, Eric, and a longtime creative partner, Gabrielle. Under the lockdowns, we began conducting interviews over Zoom. After the way the first Plandemic was attacked, I was surprised that so many high-level professionals were willing to risk their careers and lives to work with us. It was an honor to interface with top virologists, immunologists, infectious disease experts, and even a couple of renowned Nobel laureates. I saw it as a testament to the severity of corruption within the medical industry that such accomplished professionals were willing to take such a risk. I learned so much through that process. I had completed well over 30 interviews when I began receiving messages from friends suggesting that I look into a patent expert named Dr. David Martin. One of my researchers, Sean, was insistent that I interview Dr. Martin. He shared one of David's videos with me, and to be honest, the information went over my head. I couldn't fully comprehend the impact of information Dr. Martin was sharing. Trusting my team, I agreed to a Zoom call.
That call started off like every other interview Mickey had done.
Halfway into the interview, as David was on a roll, I leaned over to look around my computer monitor to make eye contact with Eric. I mouthed the words, "Let's stop." Eric whispered, "Why, what's wrong?" I said, "This guy is brilliant. We have to do this one in person. Get him on the next flight."
Dr. Martin was in Ojai the next day. The information he had shared was so precise and critical that it changed the entire narrative of the project. I later asked Dr. Martin what was going through his mind when he agreed to go all in on the project. At a time when everything Plandemic adjacent was considered beyond controversial, what motivated him as a financial analyst and researcher to associate himself so publicly with them?
I figured that they had heard a couple of my YouTube videos and come away with the same conclusion as many viewers. This is either absolutely crazy or some of the most important information that we can get across. It's likely that both options were somewhere in the consideration. As I was flying out to California, what was going through my mind was that I'm not the COVID guy. I'm a guy who talks on CNBC and Bloomberg about the markets. I'm a guy who testifies in Congress about criminal conspiracies, tax fraud, and abuses of the public trust, and all kinds of other things. Whether the storyline is the abuse of breast cancer genes, white-collar crime involving corporations and universities colluding to defraud the government, intelligence failures justifying the war in Iraq, or COVID-19, I have the same story no matter who I'm talking to. So that dispassionate part of me was just thinking, I'm going to do another interview where I recite the facts of another time when patent information happened to be the thing that broke open a big story that matters to humanity.
By the time Dr. Martin arrived in Ojai, the expanded film crew was set up and ready for the interview that would become the through line of a much longer and more detailed movie they would call Plandemic Indoctrination. Mickey invited Dr. Martin to sit in the stool across from him. After some small talk and technical checks, it was time. Dr. Martin began.
I'm the developer of linguistic genomics, which was the first platform on which you could determine the intent of communication rather than the literal artifact of communication. A niche field in the development of artificial intelligence and communications, linguistic genomics is designed to uncover the intent of communication versus the literal translation. You often see this at work in search engine results, for example, as the algorithms have become much more intent-driven over time. For example, if you search restaurants, your first result will not be a definition or a cultural history of restaurants. The search engine understands that your intent is most likely to find restaurants near you, and that's what it will serve up. If you search for Oscars, practically no search results will be related to an individual of that name. Instead, the search engine understands that you are likely searching for the Academy Awards and will deliver you results around that intent. The literal artifacts of communication, your words, are not the same as your intent. On a higher level, computers can analyze huge portions of text communication to flag underlying messages and trends that humans can't even recognize or comprehend. We've also used that technology for a number of other applications in defense, intelligence, and finance, such as flagging tax fraud based on deviation and patterns outside of a normal human scope of understanding.
Dr. Martin's company also keeps a running algorithm intended to pinpoint situations where international actors could be making decisions that would put all of humanity at risk.
We maintain a series of inquiries into every individual, every organization, and every company that is involved in anything that either blurs the line of biological and chemical weapons or crosses that line in any of 168 countries.
Most relevant to Mickey was Dr. Martin's research on U.S. patents. In 1998, Dr. Martin founded MCAM, Mosaic Collateral Asset Management.
The goal of the company was singular. It was to provide a mechanism for banks to use intangible assets, patents and copyrights and trademarks and things like that, as collateral for lending. We thought, naively as it would turn out, that the patent office would be one of those relatively boring old institutions that wasn't really overly corrupt. We thought wrong.
In 1998, IBM signed a contract with the United States that facilitated the digitization of 1 million patents. For researchers like Dr. Martin, this was a goldmine. Like never before, the history of innovation in America had been converted into a data set that could be analyzed from infinite perspectives. Researchers could identify trends that could catalyze new discoveries or roadblocks to innovation that could be removed. What he found, though, was much more surprising and chilling.
Approximately one-third of all patents filed in the United States were functional forgeries, meaning that while they had linguistic variations, they actually covered the same subject matter. In other instances, when a company's patent was expiring or an inventor went from one firm to another, they would duplicate a filing in a process referred to as double patenting.
It was clear that businesses were engaging in all kinds of subterfuge under the state cover of the U.S. Patent Office. Dr. Martin and his team actually read the substance of the patents and not just the abstract, something few Americans had ever done. What they found only solidified their growing concern that scientists and big business were pulling one over on the American public.
Within these documents, there are a lot of things being disclosed that are not what the title or the abstract or any superficial level of the patent actually was. For example, patents for a nuclear reactor that were examined in the patent office by the patent examiners for bathroom fixtures. I was thinking, this can't be real. It was real.
In May 2001, Dr. Martin brought his findings to Congress for a hearing in the Subcommittee on Courts, the Internet and Intellectual Property of the Committee on the Judiciary of the House of Representatives. Then Representative Howard Berman of California called Dr. Martin's findings astonishing, as other members of the committee, including Lindsey Graham, listened rapt. Also listening, the companies whose patents Dr. Martin was exploring.
These companies realized, we might be in trouble. And so what they did was they started donating their patents to universities and taking hundreds of millions of dollars of tax deductions as a result. Here's how it would work. First, a company like DuPont or Monsanto would donate a patent to the university. The company would assign almost any value they wanted to the patent, perhaps saying it was worth $50 million. They'd use the $50 million donation for their own tax benefit, and the university could then turn around and tell the government that they had received a matching grant of $50 million from a company. They could use that to then get $50 million in real cash from people like Dr. Fauci, since federal grant rules require universities to prove that they have industrial partnerships. Billions of dollars were being stolen and extorted from the government using the pen. No one had any idea. We wondered what other criminal enterprises and what other illicit activities were being hidden. The amazing thing is the audacity of criminal organizations. They hide their actions in plain sight. They hide them in places where nobody will ever think to look. Not surprisingly, patents, because nobody reads them, happen to be a good place to conceal illicit activities. That included activities by the government. For example, you have a lot of people talking about the fact that the United States is only focused on its biologic agent program for defensive purposes. Then you see a United States patent for a blast-resistant pathogen fired from a rocket-propelled grenade. Last time I checked, a blast-resistant pathogen from a rocket-propelled grenade is hardly a vaccine in a syringe.
The words tell the story. Almost without trying, Dr. Martin had stumbled on the ultimate source document, a map showing exactly what the U.S. government, big business, big science, and academia were really up to. Layers below all of the press releases, the patents were where the truth came to rest. Dr. Martin kept digging to find it.
The only place you can go to validate the things that we actually uncovered are the digital fingerprints of the perpetrators of the crime, the filed patents themselves. If you get the words that people use, then you can use that to track down their grants, and you can try to track down their affiliations. Before long, you see that the Patent Office, the CDC, the FDA, the NIH, and the National Science Foundation are all in this massive collusive network, which is essentially a way to take public funds and underwrite corporate programs, and probably most egregiously, pay exorbitant amounts of money to universities that rely on federal grants as one of their primary funding sources. Ultimately, the patent represents the commercial greed of an individual or organization, because what they're trying to do when a patent is filed is the obstruction of the free market by definition. As a result of that, there is a high incentive to obstruct free markets across the system, and there is a high incentive to lie about it. And it turns out that when nobody was watching the store, both of those happened.
Before interviewing Dr. Martin, the Plandemic research team conducted a thorough background check to see whether he was for real or yet another conspiracy kook who had made the internet his soapbox. Without exception, word came back. David is the real deal. What's more, when they had told him that he'd checked out, he wasn't offended, as others might have been. Instead, he said that it was par for the course at this point.
If you take your work seriously, you check your sources. That's pretty much the universal response. People find it so incredible that it's this egregious and this visible. They doubt that it could be possible.
At heart, Dr. Martin reminded me, his company deals with investments.
Because of SEC rules and banking rules and international rules, I have to maintain what's called an FBI-level chain of custody of all of our documents. So when I say something exists, I don't have a hunch. I know what I'm saying is exactly what I'm saying. The fact is, that's not a standard most people live with. When people say to me, "That's unbelievable," I remind them that this isn't about belief. It's about information that is, in most cases, hard for the average person to find. Even if you know that $191 billion in federal funds went out through the NIAID, and even if you know that a certain amount went to China, and a certain amount went to NGOs, how can you ever track what it was spent on? Well, patents are the best way to do it.
In the late 1990s, a new and puzzling trend was emerging in that sea of data. During 1999 alone, 59 new patents were issued for medical discoveries related to the coronavirus disease family. Where is this new global interest coming from? More important, where would it lead? Above all, why in 2002 did the University of North Carolina patent a recombinant version of coronavirus that had been adapted specifically to target human lung cells months before the invention of SARS? Hong Kong, China, March 2003. The year 2003 was a dark one in Hong Kong. In February, the government proposed a bill that would bring back harsh anti-dissident regulations not seen since the era of British colonial rule. Intended to prohibit any act of treason, secession, sedition, subversion against the central people's government, it was interpreted as a free pass for government officials to crush their detractors. Protests erupted, and the eyes of the world were watching. What came next, though, was even more devastating. On March 11, Hong Kong recorded its first case of SARS-CoV-1, a coronavirus causing respiratory infection. In the first 3 months alone, nearly 2,000 cases were identified, and hundreds died. SARS was entirely new and had never before been seen in humans or in animals. The international medical community swung into action. According to Dr. Martin, it wasn't just to save lives.
In 2003, the Centers for Disease Control saw the possibility of a gold strike, and that was the coronavirus outbreaks that happened in Asia. They saw that a virus they knew could be easily manipulated was something that was very valuable, and in 2003, they sought to patent it. They made sure that they controlled the proprietary rights to the disease, to the virus, and to its detection and all of the measurement of it.
In response to Dr. Martin's claims in Plandemic Indoctrination, CDC spokesman Lelwyn Grant told the Associated Press that their intention in filing a patent for coronavirus in April 2003 was to prevent other bad actors from doing just that.
The whole purpose of the patent is to prevent folks from controlling the technology. This is being done to give the industry and other researchers reasonable access to the samples.
While his argument may make sense at first, the reality is that it's patently false. Publishing the science would make it part of the public domain, and therefore not patentable by anyone. Patents are not about protecting the science. They are solely focused on control and commercial gain. Plus, if the CDC were so intent on making the research information public, why would they file a request at the patent office to keep the patent application secret? To Dr. Martin, that much was obvious.
We know that Anthony Fauci, that Ralph Baric, that the Centers for Disease Control, and a laundry list of people who wanted to take credit for inventing coronavirus were at the hub of this story. From 2003 to 2018, They controlled 100% of the cash flow that built the empire around the industrial complex of coronavirus.
What's more, the very patent itself was in a gray area, legally speaking.
Under 35 U.S. Code, Section 101, nature is prohibited from being patented. Either SARS coronavirus was manufactured, therefore making a patent on it legal, or it was natural, therefore making a patent on it illegal. If it was manufactured, it was a violation of biological and chemical weapons treaties and laws. If it was natural, filing a patent on it was illegal. In either outcome, both are illegal.
At the time the patent was filed, it was certainly controversial. Labs around the world scrambled to file their own competing patents in the hopes of getting credit for their early discoveries. One company working on a vaccine suggested that if they didn't get the patent, they'd stop their research. If we didn't have patent protection, we wouldn't invest in the research, Combi Matrix President and Chief Executive Amit Kumar said in one interview. To many, though, the rush for a patent and profits was a disturbing illustration of how Big Pharma was pushing boundaries. These are discoveries of nature, and it's baloney that we allow patents on living things, Jeremy Rifkin, a prominent anti-biotechnology author, told the AP.
We didn't allow chemists to patent the periodic table. There's no patent on hydrogen. And I don't see why they can patent discoveries of nature. Since 1980, however, the United States government has allowed people to patent living things, as long as they are a new discovery relevant to modern needs, and discovered using sophisticated scientific techniques. The legal argument was a twisted one. The CDC's patent covers the isolated coronavirus genome, isolated coronavirus proteins, and isolated nucleic acid molecules.
According to John Dole, Director of Biotechnology for the Patent Office, that was enough to merit the application. It must have a real-world utility, and there has to be the hand of man involved, he said in an NBC News report in October 2003. The isolated nucleic acid molecules represented the hand of man, and the CDC was awarded the patent in 2004. It's important to note that while COVID-19 is commonly referred to as being caused by coronavirus, the term refers to a set of clinical symptoms, and there's no evidence linking the most recent SARS-CoV-2 to a particular clinical expression of disease. COVID-19 was not disclosed until 2020, despite the 2012 Chinese data captured in an August 2020 New York Post article showing that bat guano miners had identical symptoms leading to the Wuhan virus sample. But other coronaviruses were known to scientists far earlier. It's analogous to a species in animals. While that initial patent may have been well-intended, that was only the beginning.
They actually filed patents on not only the virus, but they also filed patents on its detection and a kit to measure it. Because of that CDC patent, they had the ability to control who was authorized and who is not authorized to make independent inquiries into coronavirus. You cannot look at the virus, you cannot measure it, you cannot develop a test kit for it without CDC authorization. By ultimately receiving the patents that constrained anyone from using it, they had the means, they had the motive, and most of all, they had the monetary gain from turning coronavirus from a pathogen to profit.
Who is responsible for protecting Americans from the virus? The same people who stand to make billions if that virus became a pandemic. While it's certainly a possibility that the people involved acted purely for personal and financial gain, it's not the only interpretation of this history. The vast majority of employees and associates of the CDC, NIH, Big Pharma, and their numerous allies sincerely care about saving lives. The same can be said for the vast majority of medical professionals. Most would choose death before they would break their oath. Yet again, what's important to take away from this history is the fact that nearly everyone involved with monitoring and solving the pandemic problem stood to make a lot of money because of their position at the wheel. It's so crucial to be aware of the conflicts of interest, especially because of what happened next.
Somewhere between 2012 and 2013, something happened. The federal funding for research that was feeding into places like Harvard, Emory, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, that funding suddenly became impaired by something that happened at the NIH, where the NIH got this little tiny moment of clarity and said, I think something we're doing is wrong.
In 2014, the NIH said, gain-of-function research on coronavirus should be suspended. Gain-of-function studies are studies that increase the transmissibility of a disease. Gain-of-function research is often necessary in order to study how a disease affects humans and how to cure it. If a disease isn't strong enough to infect an animal or human cell at its most basic level, scientists must teach it to become infectious before they can study the aftermath. Obviously, the danger is that once scientists teach a virus to infect humans, it could then escape and wreak havoc. Despite robust safety protocols, breaches continue to plague medical laboratories, and the risks to humanity are ever present. A statement released by NIH Director Francis S. Collins at the time read, NIH has funded such studies because they help define the fundamental nature of human-pathogen interactions, enable the assessment of the pandemic potential of emerging infectious agents, and inform public health and preparedness efforts. These studies, however, also entail biosafety and biosecurity risks, which need to be understood better. NIH will be adhering to this funding pause until the robust and broad deliberative process described by the White House, including consultation with the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity and input from the National Research Council of the National Academies, is completed. However, there was a bit of a small print that followed, and it made all the difference to coronavirus researchers. During this pause, NIH will not provide new funding for any projects involving these experiments, Collins stated. Anyone currently conducting this type of work was encouraged to voluntarily pause their research until the government could make final recommendations, which was expected to take many years. What to do in the meantime? Dr. Martin explained.
You offshore the research. You fund the Wuhan Institute of Virology to do the stuff that sounds like it's getting a little edgy with respect to its morality and legality. But do you do it straight away? No. You run the money through a series of cover organizations to make it look like you're funding a U.S. operation, which then subcontracts to the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
In April 2020, Newsweek magazine stated, the NIH, with NIAID director Dr. Anthony Fauci's backing, promised $7.4 million to the EcoHealth Alliance to study bat coronaviruses from 2014 to 2019. And in doing so, to conduct gain-of-function research. A large portion of that went to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The lab also received millions from a program called PREDICT, funded by the United States Agency for International Development, which works closely with the NIH. Why send money from American taxpayers to a lab in China? To start, despite the ban, NIAID head Dr. Fauci was determined to see gain-of-function research continue. A huge proponent of such research, Fauci had already written a controversial op-ed for the Washington Post in 2011, arguing for the importance of his own gain-of-function research on the bird flu. Determining the molecular Achilles heel of these viruses can allow scientists to identify novel antiviral drug targets that could be used to prevent infection in those at risk or to better treat those who become infected, he wrote with two co-authors on December 30, 2011. Decades of experience tells us that disseminating information gained through biomedical research to legitimate scientists and health officials provides a critical foundation for generating appropriate countermeasures and, ultimately, protecting the public health. The Obama administration disagreed, and the ban came down in 2014, effectively ending that argument. In 2017, however, the NIH ended the ban under President Trump and fired up gain-of-function research stateside with one caveat. A secret panel of experts would weigh the risks and potential benefits and decide who would be allowed to proceed. Scientists around the world were outraged to find that such delicate decisions were being made behind closed doors, especially when it was revealed that two risky flu studies, Fauci's area of focus, had been approved. In early 2019, Tom Inglesby of Johns Hopkins University and Mark Lipsitch of Harvard wrote a blistering op-ed for the Washington Post, ringing the alarm about the controversial research practices that had been fired up again. "We have serious doubts about whether these experiments should be conducted at all," they wrote. "With deliberations kept behind closed doors, none of us will have the opportunity to understand how the government arrived at these decisions or to judge the rigor and integrity of that process." For Dr. Fauci and other gain-of-function researchers, China represented the ultimate closed door, Dr. Martin told Mickey. Despite the risks, and past investigations had proved that there were plenty at the Wuhan lab, millions of dollars continued to flow in. For the NIH bigwigs, that also minimized the potential risks to their reputations. In the event of a security breach, Dr. Martin explained in his interview with Mickey,
"The U.S. could say, China did it. China could say, the U.S. did it. The cool thing is, both of them are almost telling the truth because they did it together.